Is aging inevitable? And if so, why?
The conundrum is that there seem to be aging genes, genes that have no other purpose than to destroy us. Well, what gives? We thought we understood how evolution works, and we thought it was about optimizing individual fitness. Well, aging destroys individual fitness, and yet evolution seems to have preferred aging to non-aging.
That's Josh Middledorf. We talk with him about his book, Cracking the Aging Code. It's about why we age and what we can do to slow it down. Then, we explore a novel about a man who never dies. We talk with Aaron Tier about his new work of fiction, Mr. Eternity. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and on the web at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Josh Middledorf is the kind of scientist who likes breaking down boundaries. He started out as a theoretical physicist, but then got interested in life extension. He was curious, why does a near-starvation diet seem to prolong life in mammals? It seemed counterintuitive. So he turned his scientific research to evolutionary biology and embarked on a quest to crack the aging code. Why do we age? Why do different species age at different rates? And is there anything we can do about how evolution programs aging into our genes? In his new book, Cracking the Aging Code, Middledorf teamed up with co-author Dorian Sagan to tackle the conundrum. If aging is so bad for us, why is it so good for our species? Along the way, the authors demolish some popular shibboleths about aging and confront readers with a question. Should we try to live forever? Or should we just make the best of our time on Earth, living as long and healthy as we can? Josh Middledorf has worked in astrophysics, optical design, and energy conservation. He's taught statistics, physics, math, astronomy, and evolution at Harvard, Berkeley, UPenn, Bryn Mawr, and other universities. Well, Josh Middledorf, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Well, thanks for having me. I've looked forward to this interview for a long time.
Tell us a little bit about how you got into the aging issue.
I started reading about caloric restriction, experiments where they extended the life of many kinds of animals in the lab just by feeding them less. And that didn't make any sense to me. You know, I'd been trying to feed myself just as much good food as I could to keep my life long. But animals that are starved live longer. One of the things that I figured out from that is that aging must be programmed. I mean, there's nothing that an animal can do with less food that it couldn't do with more food. So it's not trying to live a long time. And that was really the germ of this book, and it was the germ of what motivated me to switch fields and become an evolutionary biologist.
Explain the conundrum. You call it a conundrum that you explore in your book. And that is that you say if aging destroys our fitness, then why does evolution put up with it?
The standard model of how evolution works is if there's a gene that promotes itself, then that gene does better. And if that gene destroys itself, then that gene does work. For example, a gene that makes stronger muscles, well, that helps you to compete in the world, do better than your other individuals, and you're likely to survive better. And so a gene for stronger muscles is a selfish gene. A gene for fertility is a gene that makes more copies of itself. And it's easy to understand how genes like that make it into the genome and stay into the genome. The conundrum is that there seem to be aging genes, genes that have no other purpose than to destroy us. And these genes come from an ancient lineage. There's no question that they're there on purpose because they've been preserved since the earliest eukaryotic life. In other words, since life first became complex and multicellular 500 million years ago, these same genes have been preserved that cause aging. And yet, the genes do not promote their own prospects. These genes are the opposite of selfish genes. They destroy the very vehicle that's carrying them. Well, what gives? We thought we understood how evolution works, and we thought it was about optimizing individual fitness. Well, aging destroys individual fitness, and yet evolution seems to have preferred aging to non-aging.
So why would something like starving yourself, which seems rather self-destructive, lead to living longer?
Well, that takes me way ahead. I think of that as a clue to, well, how can it be? What is the possible advantage to aging? Actually, years after my discovery of the conundrum, I discovered what I think is the solution to the conundrum, which is that aging promotes population stability. If it weren't for aging, then what would kill us? Well, we'd die of starvation, or we would die of an epidemic. These forms of death take everybody at the same time. If I can find enough to eat, probably you can too. Under conditions where the population is spread out, diseases are really relatively rare. It's conditions of crowding and want that create the epidemics that kill everybody at the same time. So without aging, you would have death that's very clumped up. Either no one would be dying for long periods of time, the population would expand explosively, and then the population comes crashing down when everybody dies at the same time. Well, you can't build an ecosystem this way. If you want a stable ecosystem, you have to have a level death rate. And that's what aging is about. To understand the evolutionary purpose of aging, you have to look at whole ecologies and understand that aging promotes a level death rate, which makes stable ecologies possible.
You know, it has always seemed to me when I hear people who are into living forever, you know, the longevity community, who say that we're going to destroy death. And when I listen to that, people talking about becoming immortal, I just get sick to my stomach because aren't there too many people already on this planet?
Well, yeah. As a matter of fact, we are the top predator. We have pushed aside many other species. We're in the midst of a global extinction, the likes of which the planet Gaia has never seen before. This is the fastest and most devastating extinction in the history of life on Earth. And there's no question it's being caused by humans. One of the keys to understanding aging, something that I learned to think about as I came into the evolutionary field, is that evolution works on many levels at once. And what's good for the individual isn't necessarily good for the community. This is the concept of the tragedy of the commons. Everybody does what's good for himself, which is to take more and more from me, to exploit maximally the resources that are common for everybody. But the result, everyone acting in a way that's perfectly rational for the self, is a tragedy of the commons. It's a tragedy for everybody together. What happens is that you eventually use up all the resources that we all depend on. Without cooperation, without making agreements that we're going to moderate our use of resources, the tragedy of the commons is inevitable. So, yes, the extension of human life is good for the individual. It's disastrous for the Earth as a whole. And if we're going to go on with a life extension program, the only hope that we would have is with radical conservation techniques to reduce the human footprint, along with draconian birth control. I'm afraid we have to limit the human population perhaps to what it is, perhaps even to less than what the population is at present.
So your book delves into the role that aging plays in evolution, but it also puts a lot of emphasis on the different ways that aging itself works. Now, one of the things you do say is that our bodies don't wear out. I mean, that, I think that's the idea that we have. You know, it certainly feels to me like my body is wearing out. What do you mean when you say our bodies don't wear out?
Yes, it's a common belief that people, animals, plants wear out the same way a knife gets dull, the same way the pipes in your house get clogged with deposits and they need to be replaced after a while. Well, isn't that the way our arteries work? They get clogged with fatty deposits, and that's what causes heart disease. This is an age-old idea, but yes, it has no scientific support, and it's really something that scientists agree on. This is not the meaning of aging. So how to understand that in an easy way? One way to understand it is to know that there are some animals and many plants that don't age at all. And that would be pretty hard to explain if aging were just a physical law of nature. There are trees that just grow bigger and bigger over time. There's a physical law called the second law of thermodynamics, and that says entropy must increase, things wear out, randomness eventually sets in. But life has found an end run around that second law. What life does is to take in energy from the environment and dump its entropy back out as waste. That's the game that life plays, and it makes growth possible, it makes evolution possible, and there's no reason that that plan couldn't go on forever and ever. Our lives are limited by something going on inside the body and not by an inevitable physical law. And this is really something that scientists do agree on.
So you talk about three evolutionary stories about aging. Why don't you tell us what those stories are?
Well, there are only three accepted theories of what aging is. One is that aging just doesn't matter at all. Aging is an artifact of protected environments. In the natural world, everything starves or gets eaten by a predator before it gets old enough to experience aging. So aging didn't have to evolve. It's just a question of there's no selection pressure after a certain age. There's no motivation for anything to live a long time because in nature, nothing does live that long. And the second theory is about trade-offs. It says that the body can't do everything well. There are resources that could be used to preserve the body for the long haul, or the same resources are in competition to reproduce right now, to be stronger right now, to up the level of your metabolism, to goose your reproductive hormones. And that these are in conflict. So there's a compromise. The body takes care of itself, but not that well. And in the long run, the body suffers from not investing enough in repair and maintenance. And this second is the dominant theory in the evolutionary science today. And the third theory is that aging is simply programmed into our genes the same way at a certain time of life we grow, and then at a time we turn on our sexuality, become able to reproduce. That program continues, and we develop hormones that actually destroy us. The body is programmed to grow for a while, to reproduce for a while, and then to destroy itself using, for example, inflammation, using programmed cell death. The body is destroying itself with age. And that third theory is not popular, but it's the one that I'm promoting in my book.
Yeah, that reminds me of, you know, when I gave birth to my son, I had a very strong sense that, you know, whereas before then I had the sense that I was kind of maturing And then after that happened, I felt like I started to die. Not because motherhood was bad, but just in the way you just spoke about it, that I had reproduced. And in a way, my body was now beginning to switch on a different program. So that is interesting to hear you say that. But, you know, what's also interesting is how this is not just a book about...
Well, just let me drop in a couple of comments about that. One is that it's absolutely true, it's a part of aging theory that I agree with, that aging can't evolve until the first reproduction, and that there is no aging before the first reproduction. So what you are sensing is absolutely real. There's another part of evolutionary theory that says that there's this trade-off, and the more children you have, the more you're using up your body's resources, and the shorter you live. And that's absolutely wrong. It's wrong in animals. It's wrong in humans. There's no relationship between how many children you have and how long you live. Maybe there's a small positive relationship, in fact, that people with more children, especially people who have children later in life, tend to live a little bit longer than others. So this is another area in which evolutionary theory has just failed completely, this idea that evolution forces a trade-off between reproduction and long-term survival, and that's what aging is about. It just fails completely because there is no trade-off. People who have a lot of children don't have shorter lives. They have slightly longer lives. Sorry, that's my interruption.
Well, no, I'm really glad you said that. Your book, Josh Middledorf, this book which you co-authored with Dorian Sagan, Cracking the Aging Code, doesn't just talk about aging. It also is a kind of sociology of science around aging, you know, and explores how scientific knowledge is in effect curated, or even we could say censored. And you refer to the fact of these three different theories, and that the theory that you were going on is not the accepted one. I wonder if you could talk about how this scientific community evolved the dominant theory of aging, why you think it evolved that, and why it resists the one that you have.
Yes, this is a sub-theme in the book, and it really comes from my own experience when I came out with my theory of aging. I was so proud of it, I just broadcast it in the evolutionary community, and I got back from them a rejection in no uncertain terms. My first paper was submitted to the Journal of Theoretical Biology, JTB, and I got back, instead of a peer review, normally they'd send this out and, you know, three different scientists would say what they think of it. I got back a one-line peer review that said, JTB shouldn't touch this topic with a 10-foot pole. They wouldn't even consider my paper for review. So what goes on there? The short version is that I learned that there's a prejudice in the community in terms of the selfish gene version of evolution. This wasn't Darwin's idea, but it was a version of evolutionary theory that came to the fore in the 20th century and became really a dominant form that you can't oppose around 1960 and 1970, that says that everything in evolution happens one gene at a time. Competition is only individual versus individual, and there is no such thing as cooperation. If it looks like cooperation, it's just selfish genes trying to protect other copies of those same genes. But there is no real cooperation in nature. Cooperation is just an illusion. Now, for you and me and for your listeners, this has got to seem like it's crazy. I mean, you look around and you see cooperation everywhere in nature. And yet there's this dogma that says that cooperation isn't real. Cooperation is an illusion. And in fact, it's impossible for real cooperation to evolve. And that's what I was up against when I was pushing my theory out into the evolutionary community. It's not that my theory was brand new and nobody had thought of it before. It's that thinking in terms of groups was completely anathema to the way that evolutionary biologists think.
Well, that's so interesting because it really is a kind of social Darwinism.
Oh, you bet. I think it's very closely related. In fact, the person who came up really most responsible for what's called the new synthesis or neo-Darwinism, the person most responsible for that was R.A. Fisher, Ronald Fisher, who was born in the, I believe, the 1880s, who did his most impressive work in 1930 when he wrote a book which is still the textbook for neo-Darwinism, How Evolution Works. It's the foundation of the selfish gene theory. And he was, on the one hand, an incredible mathematical genius. He gave us really the foundation of current day statistics. On the other hand, he was a racist. He believed in eugenics. Eugenics is the idea that humans have to collectively decide who should reproduce and who shouldn't, because without that, the poor people are going to reproduce and the rich people are going to reproduce less. And gee, the poor people are stupider than we are, and they're less fit and they're contributing less to society. And the poor people who are less fit are going to take over. This was really the motivation for Fisher's work. And half of his book is the foundation of selfish gene theory, which is accepted evolutionary science today. The other half was just a political screed on eugenics, on how terrible the lower classes are and how they're destroying England. It was pure racism. So there is a historic connection, which I think continues to this day, between the idea of the selfish gene and the social Darwinist idea that pure competition is really the best economic system, and that those who succeed in society are those who are contributing most to society.
Isn't it pretty well established that human evolution was driven by cooperation?
I think so. Darwin wrote a whole book on this topic called The Descent of Man, in which he talked about tribes that functioned well together being dominant over tribes that cooperated less well. And yet this idea is completely at odds with the selfish gene theory, which is the mainstream of evolutionary science today.
Well, Josh Middledorf, let's go back, though, to the mechanism of aging. You've mentioned inflammation. You also talk about telomeres and cell senescence, and you talk about apoptosis. Let's explain them. How about the telomeres first?
To give some context to this, I talk about four primary ways in which the body destroys itself with age. One of them is thymic involution. The thymus is a little gland that really your immune system depends on completely, and it just gets smaller and smaller and disappears into a lump of fat as we get older. So our immune systems disappear. Another is programmed cell death. Programmed cell death is necessary to protect the body. Apoptosis is another way to pronounce this. It's really an essential part of biology. But as we get older, it's on a hair trigger. And cells that are perfectly healthy and contributing to the body are destroying themselves. And that's what sarcopenia is about. That's why our muscles get weaker. And the third is inflammation. Inflammation is another self-protective mechanism. It's the body's first line of defense against invading microbes. But inflammation turns against the body and, again, destroys healthy tissues as we get older. Inflammation is associated with all of the diseases of old age. Alzheimer's, heart disease, and cancer are all heavily influenced by inflammation. And the fourth is telomere biology, which is what you asked about. So let's go into that more deeply. So every time a cell divides, its chromosomes get a little shorter. Well, the chromosomes are the DNA. That's the instructions for the body. How can we live with the telomeres that get shorter each time the cell divides? Well, there are two ways that the body copes with this. The short-term solution is that the chromosome is buffered on both ends with telomeres. They're just repeat DNA, the same sequence over and over and over again, that contains no information. And it doesn't matter for a while if you lose some of it. But eventually, you've got to rebuild the telomere. I mean, you have a lifetime worth of telomere when you're born, but eventually the body has to have a way of restoring it, and that's the enzyme telomerase. Telomerase just grows a new telomere, so that repeat segment, there's a little template for creating the repeat sequence that's part of the telomerase enzyme, and it's applied over and over and over and over again until it makes the telomere full length. So the key thing here is that telomerase comes out when we are in utero. It comes out when the sperm meets the egg, and it comes out in early stages of development, so that an embryo has full-length telomeres. But it's all downhill after that. Telomerase is then put back in the lockbox. It doesn't ever come out again. And the telomeres just get shorter and shorter and shorter. Even during the embryonic development, the telomeres are getting shorter, so that by the time we're born, half of our telomeres are gone, and the other half get used up during our lifetime. So this is a lot of what drives aging, is that cells are losing their telomeres. The telomeres get shorter each time cells divide during our lives, and cells with short telomeres become toxic to the body. They don't just stop working, they actually send out signals that make us old and die.
So with that understanding then, the last part of the book, with all that you've explained about how aging is an evolutionary program basically to protect the survival of our species, you go into a fair amount of detail in how we can prolong our lives, what we can do to prevent our telomeres from getting shorter, or at least to slow that down, how we can combat inflammation. In fact, you run the website agingadvice.org. Isn't all this kind of hypocritical?
Yes. I plead guilty. Friends discovered that I'd been studying aging, and people started asking, how do you keep your body young? And for their sake, I put together this website. I compiled what I do and created the website agingadvice.org. But there's no question that what's good for the individual is bad for the community in this case. And I have not completely resolved that. To mitigate the damage, I would say everybody who is an advocate for life extension has to think globally as well. If you're an advocate for life extension, you're also an advocate for draconian birth control. Really, it can't be based on individual choice. Much as I have libertarian tendencies, and I just feel I don't trust the state, then I can throw them. But some social controls need to be placed on who can reproduce. Just allowing everybody to have as many children as possible is not going to work. The easier part of it is technology. We just haven't even begun yet to explore the technology for recycling, for alternative energy, and we're still in the habit from the 19th century of digging up the ground and turning it into products that we throw away, as if the resources were unlimited and as if the earth were a sink that we could just throw everything away and not pay the consequences. Well, there is no away. I'm giving this interview from China. I'm in China at National Institute for Biological Science this fall. I have a gig here. And really, you can see the results of human crowding in China better than anywhere else in the world. Yeah, can you imagine? China has 1.5 billion people now, despite the one-child policy that was enforced during the 70s and 80s and 90s. And even now, there's some of the one-child policy remains. China would have 3 or 4 or 5 billion people today if it hadn't been for the one-child policy. And as I look around Beijing and the crowded subways, even the parks are overcrowded. There's garbage everywhere. The pollution in Beijing is some of the worst in the world. What would this country do if there were 3 or 4 times as many people? But we shouldn't pin the ecological devastation caused by humans on increased lifespan alone, or even primarily. In fact, life extension is just one small piece of the story. If human lifespan does not increase at all, even if human lifespan were to decrease, we would still need both a new conservation economy and radical population control measures in order to halt a global ecosystem collapse that's already well underway.
Yes, and your book, Josh Middledorf, Cracking the Aging Code, is a fascinating journey into all these questions. I highly recommend it to our listeners. Thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Well, thank you. This has been a real pleasure.
Josh Middledorf. Go to writersvoice.net for links to his blogs about aging and to read an excerpt from Cracking the Aging Code. Next up, following the history of one very long-lived character from the year 1560 to the year 2500. Stay tuned after the break.
Oh, very young, what will you leave us this time?
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. In our first segment today, we talked about aging. Now, let's consider the opposite, immortality. That's what my guest Aaron Teer does in his new novel, Mr. Eternity. It's a hilarious, picaresque romp through 1,000 years in the life of its protagonist, the world explorer, quack doctor, and seeker, Daniel Defoe. Not the Daniel Defoe of Robinson Crusoe, or maybe so. In any event, Mr. Eternity gives the reader the chance to take the long view, the very long view, and consider how we got to where we are right now and where we're going. We move back and forth between times, 1560, 1750, 2016, 2250, and 2500, seeing past and future through the eyes of their contemporaries. Aaron Teer is the author of the novel The Ghost Apple. He writes a column, Food and Consequences, for Lucky Peach, and he's a regular book critic for The Nation. Aaron Teer, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me.
So this book, the Mr. Eternity of the title, is a man who appears to be immortal. He calls himself Daniel Defoe. The book's action ranges from 1560 to the year 2500. First, I just want to ask you, how did this amazing idea come to you to write the book and to write this character?
Well, the character, it's hard to say. It's always hard to say about that kind of thing. He sort of appeared as a voice, you know, and it was a voice that was talking, and gradually he became himself. And it's kind of hard to give a clearer account of it than that. But I suppose the idea of the book, or the ambition of the book, is to, you know, talk about this big sweep of time and talk about it in a way that gives you a sense of that time passing rather than, you know, a kind of more prosaic account of the time passing. So I wanted these spaces in between, and I needed a kind of narrator or a kind of touchstone figure who could be playful about it, whose memory was imperfect, you know, so you got a sense of all this, you know, sort of time vanishing behind you. And while I was writing it, my grandfather was dying after a long, happy life. And he would tell me these stories about his life that I knew to be, you know, factually incorrect and in some sense outrageous. But it was so clear that to him they were true. And that was kind of magical to me at the time.
And so now tell us about this character, Daniel Defoe, and his name. Of course, we know Daniel Defoe wrote Robinson Crusoe. You call him Daniel Defoe in different iterations, but he's also called the Ancient Mariner with shades of Samuel Taylor Coleridge. So tell us about the character and the references to his names.
Sure. Well, you know, somebody, I was doing an interview the other day, and somebody asked me very reasonably, why did you call him Daniel Defoe? And I found myself giving this long explanation, you know. So Daniel Defoe, he was born Dan Foe. He was this kind of, you know, a kind of rogue. He spent some time in debtor's prison. We really don't know much about him. And sort of looking back on that, on the real Daniel Defoe, it sometimes seems as if he's just kind of passing in and out of view, and maybe his life could extend infinitely into the future and the past. And, you know, this kind of fanciful notion was more plausible with the figure about whom we didn't know as much. But the truth is that that's not at all the reason. I think really there is no... It was a whimsical notion, you know? And then suddenly it seemed correct. And so much of writing a book works like that. You are writing your rough draft and you have these notions, and some of them are, you know, kind of insupportable or unacceptable somehow, and some of them strike a weird, appropriate note. And then afterwards, in trying to say why he's called Daniel Defoe, I'm really trying to articulate why it seemed correct that he was already called Daniel Defoe, if you understand what I mean. It wasn't a logical process, I'm saying. But his identity as a kind of, you know, he's not himself really a literary figure. He, in my mind, is not the real Daniel Defoe. So he's kind of styled himself Daniel Defoe because he's a kind of literary man in a lot of ways. He sometimes confuses his own life with Don Quixote. He has this way of telling stories, which is this kind of headlong, comic, upbeat, you know, this voice all his own. And I think that although the characters don't really say so in the book, this is a very self-conscious storytelling mode, you know, that he employs, I suppose, for his own enjoyment. And so these literary references, these two literary men call him the Ancient Mariner because the Ancient Mariner, you know, will sort of buttonhole you and tell you this long and comprehensible story. But Daniel Defoe himself, you know, could have made the same joke, I think.
So you chose the different years. We start in 1560 in Peru. Is that right? Am I remembering that correctly?
Well, they start on the, what's the vice? Well, I suppose at the time it's called the New Kingdom of Granada. It's the Venezuela, Colombia. It's the Caribbean coast. But they have to sail. They sail to Panama. They cross the isthmus, and then they sail down to Peru, because that's the way that you enter the Orinoco or the Amazon basin. You can't paddle up those giant rivers. So they do spend quite a lot of time in Peru, the Peruvian Amazon, I suppose.
Yeah, and there's a character there as well, a very compelling character, that is Ana Gloria. Tell us about her and the role she plays in this part of the story.
Well, she's not called, you know, she's an imaginary figure at that point in the story. Daniel Defoe claims to have seen a woman on the dock in Spain before he set sail with Christopher Columbus, which is 70 years before the first section. And he imagines at some point, for some reason, which he never really describes, that this person is named Ana Gloria. So then he keeps mistaking the women that he meets for this missing woman whom he spent his whole life looking for. And the narrator of the 1560 section is this, I suppose we call him a mestizo. I guess she's not a mestizo because she's a native woman, but she's been raised in a Spanish-speaking town. So she speaks this indigenous language and she speaks Spanish. And she's a figure of mystery and wonder, and Daniel Defoe is wondering the whole time whether she is, in fact, by some kind of magical, you know, transmutation, this woman that she's been looking for, that he's been looking for, rather.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I forgot. Her name is Maria, but she really tells a story of the confrontation of these two cultures, of the European culture and the indigenous culture, that I found really fascinating, kind of a disquisition into the idea of what's real. You know, depending on your culture, what becomes real, what becomes visible to you, what can you hear, what can you not hear? And I wonder if you could just expound a little bit on that idea, because she does spend a lot of time talking about you know, how she straddles these two cultures, but when she's in one, she can't hear the other. Can you explain that a little bit?
This moment of the initial contact between European people and indigenous American people who had been separated for at least 10,000 years, maybe more. You know, it's a fascinating thought and a fascinating notion, and it really is lost to us, I think, in a lot of ways. I mean, there are uncontacted people in the Brazilian and Peruvian Amazon, but, you know, they know about modern goods. They trade with other indigenous groups that know about, that have been contacted. And so it's very difficult to imagine what that initial moment was like. For me, one way of getting into it was this matter of your cultural and linguistic orientation. So I learned about a people in the Brazilian Amazon called the Pirahá, which there's a book called Don't Sleep, There Are Snakes, which is apparently a Pirahá phrase written by a guy named Daniel Everett. And the Pirahá are fascinating to linguists because they appear to lack recursion in their languages as a way of embedding subclauses. And they don't seem to speak of the future or the past outside of living memory. They don't seem to make tools of any kind of complexity. They don't have words for numbers and things. And the other thing is that they appear to have migrated there from somewhere else. So I was imagining that the tribe to which Maria belongs is some kind of ancestral version of this tribe, a kind of city-building people, a sophisticated people, kind of urbanized, cosmopolitan people who still have a language of this kind. Because it occurred to me that the Pirahá people whom Daniel Everett was interacting with were every bit as smart as he was, you know. But their language prevented them from articulating certain concepts and, you know, functioning in the world that Daniel Everett was functioning in. But, of course, they were very well suited to their own world. So I was just imagining, you know, what would a larger, urbanized, complex society look like if you had that kind of linguistic foundation? And then pitting them against the Spaniards was a way of just offering this very stark difference, these two different ways of living and trying to get at what that initial conflict must have been like, because it was a not always a bloody conflict. You know, there was plenty of friendly interactions, but trying to imagine this great sort of conceptual conflict, trying to communicate with people who don't have the same understanding of the world they live in, the people, what people are really. On a very, very fundamental level, way more fundamental than any kind of contact of that sort that's possible today.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Aaron Teer about his new novel, Mr. Eternity. And then moving on to 1750, here your narrator is someone who is passing for white but is a mulatto, living on a slave plantation in a position of privilege. Was this also a way for you to, you know, kind of fast forward on colonialism and its, you know, and its power relationships?
Yeah, of course. And complicating his relationship, making him, you know, like Maria, a man who inhabits two worlds, is also a way of thinking about this. You know, so much of history gets lost, and we think, for example, of the Spanish conquest as a, you know, it's some fighting, and then inevitably the Spaniards win, you know. And in the same way, we you know, it's easy to think of slavery as this kind of bilateral interaction. There are white people who have enslaved black people, and that's the end of the story. But in fact, it's much more complex than that. You know, in the American world in the 16th century, there are, you know, Cortes enlisted the support of other native groups when he was attacking, you know, what became Mexico City. And without that support, he wouldn't have been able to succeed. And in the same way, in the Caribbean and in the American South too, you know, there were free blacks, there were wealthy free-born, I don't like to use the word mulatto, I suppose we'd say mixed race now. There was this whole spectrum of different kinds of people which presented huge legal problems when people are writing the slave codes. And when you think about that, you just get a a better sense of what daily life might have been like, you know, kind of this infinite complexity of power relationships, and very difficult to understand where you stood in that hierarchy, and I think for a lot of people impossible to understand where they stood, which would have, I don't know, which would have lent daily life a kind of a feeling of deep insecurity, I think.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with novelist Aaron Tier about his latest book, Mr. Eternity. Then we come to the midpoint, 2016. You have two filmmakers who, you know, have heard of this guy who claims to be immortal. They're not sure to really whether to believe about him. These two young guys, you know, who think of themselves as right smack in the middle of generation credit debt, the age of irony, and the age of climate disaster. And, of course, climate disaster becomes a theme then moving forward. Tell us a little bit about 2016 and the position of that thread plays in the book.
Well, you know, it's me, I suppose. It's kind of a version of me kind of sitting in the middle of the book looking forward and looking back. And it's this moment, which is, you know, although climate change is happening right now, there haven't been any vast disturbances here in the United States. I mean, there's a devastating drought in California, but we have the infrastructure to deal with it. But it's about, I suppose, the anxiety of looking forward and imagining the world that's coming, and then trying to reconcile this kind of horrific ideal with again, daily life. So these guys are in Key West, which is a place that won't exist in really not very long. You know, and we're talking like one human lifetime, it's possible that it won't exist any longer. We don't know, of course. So it's this extremely provisional place, this extremely vulnerable place. And it's these two guys, like all the other people in the past and in the future, who are really, in a lot of ways, at the beginning of their lives. They have this kind of notion that they're going to make a documentary, but neither of them really understand how that would be, how you would go about doing that. But maybe they will become documentary filmmakers. We have no idea because they don't know themselves. They're just trying to figure it out. So that section for me is about, you know, sort of coming to adulthood and imagining what adulthood is going to look like at a time when the future is uncertain in a way that it hasn't quite been uncertain before. You know, every generation has their, you know, their sense that the world is ending, nuclear annihilation and so on. But for us, there's an inevitable and I suppose, in human terms, still relatively slow transformation of the reality in which you try to imagine a future for yourself. And I think that's really vexing and ultimately kind of impossible.
Yes, I mean, I think I remember the moment when I realized that I may very well be living in a time, in an era that is really the end of the world as we know it. And it felt to me very much that you inhabit that place too.
Yeah.
So moving forward, tell us about the U.S. and 2200.
Yeah, well, so I wanted to skip 200 years to avoid some kind of, there's vast disasters have occurred between 2016 and 2200. And since it's a relatively, in the end, a book that I thought of as kind of a joyful book and like a book that's full of love, I didn't want to, you know, write a long section about devastation and disease and so on. So the young man who's the narrator in 2200, who's named Jam, he kind of comes of age or comes to himself in this world where the coastal cities in the United States have been partially inundated, although not all the way inundated. There's been some kind of terrible problem that has reduced the United States population very significantly, and I don't specify what it is, you know, but we can imagine any number of terrifying things. So he's inhabiting this new world and this new future. And for me, the importance of this section is imagining, once again, in the future, as in the past, human beings only inhabit the present moment, right? I mean, daily life is the only life we know. So Jam lives in an impoverished world in which he kind of longs for air conditioning and like bottled water and very simple things like that. But on another level, it's perfectly possible for him to have a happy life and to do some of the things that he wants to do. And to wake up each day feeling relatively hopeful about things. And it occurred to me that that's what it is, you know, in the future, the idea of a dystopian future, it's an idea, you know, it's an imaginary idea. And it's about mapping our own expectations onto the future and imagining how horrible a future would be in which we didn't have all the things we have today. But for the people who are living in that future, that's just what life is. And it might be very difficult, but they still wake up each day, they love their children, you know, they have they're excited about whatever they're going to eat, if they have some food. But I mean, you know, the texture of daily life, these are still human beings, just like us. And they're capable of happiness. And it seemed to me like sort of unfair to Jam to bring my own kind of dread to bear on his reality. So that section is about him, in a sense, curing himself of this kind of anger about what's happened to his world.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Aaron Tier about his new novel, Mr. Eternity. And then there is perhaps one of my favorite eras. That's the one at the end of the book. Well, not at the end of the book, because these threads run throughout the book. But at the end of the time period of the book, that's 2500, where we meet an anarcho-feminist princess who has to do political fornications under the direction of her father and then escapes. Tell us about her and what that period time period is like.
Well, that's what I think was the most fun for me to write, because it's the most distant in the future, and there are no facts, so I can make everything up. Even though in a weird way it felt like I was writing journalism. But she lives in St. Louis, which has become, it's a kind of like African towns in the Sahel, you know, they're on the edge of this vast desert. All of Kansas and Nebraska and the American West is a desert. She's the princess, she's the daughter of this kind of despot. But he is a poor despot. I mean, they live in an impoverished place. And he gets kind of intoxicated by this idea of reuniting the United States, which have fallen apart, and remodernizing everything and bringing back all these old things. And so the fun of it for me is imagining how the things that we have and the world we live in could be remembered by a people who are not particularly, they're living in great material comfort, so they're not in any real hardship, and they're thinking of our world in a kind of purely intellectual way. They're excited to think about it. But of course, everything they think about it is wrong. They have no idea what our world was like. And so it's all this kind of these failed schemes to turn camels into whales and stuff. And I don't know, I think once again, it's about daily life. It's the princess is, you know, she's irritated that she has to marry these people who her father wants her to marry. And she longs, just like everyone else longs, for, you know, to be herself, to live some imaginary life that she doesn't really understand what it is yet. So I guess, you know, she's just like all of them. And that's, you know, I guess that's the whole point.
You know, I found a very key sentence in the book, at least very key and meaningful to me, because it echoes so much of my own thinking. It's on page 236. It's actually back in 1560. Maria is talking about the Christians, and she says that the Christians are mad. They wander aimlessly through the city. They are the disease, but the disease is not the plague. The disease is the future. The disease is time. The disease is a way of thinking. It doesn't kill anyone yet, but it kills things. It begins to kill the world. Could you explain what you mean by that?
Well, lots of people have spent a lot of time and energy trying to imagine why the Spaniards were so successful in overthrowing these huge, complex empires in the Americas. And there are, you know, certain tangible things, like the indigenous Americans had no experience with smallpox and yellow fever and malaria. And they didn't have domestic animals like the horse, so they couldn't travel as quickly. But then there's these other ideas, too, that there was something about this European outlook And we can wonder about what it was, you know, a kind of a goal-oriented approach or an ability to look forward into the future and to make great sacrifices and endure great personal hardship for some imaginary thing that may or may not come. So the people from whom Maria comes, the Piraha, it's not good manners to think about the future or to plan things too much. And a people like that they have no recourse when the Spaniards arrive and they're bent on taking over this city, and they're going to fight if they need to, and they're going to introduce, you know, new consumer goods, and they have all these plans. And the people who don't make plans inevitably are going to kind of fade away if there are these other people who are asserting their prerogative in this way. But it's not about, you know, which culture is better. It's about these cultures are different, and there's a kind of a process of cultural selection going on that is kind of nightmarish to think about. But I think in some cases it is what happened.
Yeah, it is what happened. And, you know, what I read into that is it's the beginning of the end of the world. I mean, they did kill the world. We are killing the world. This whole separation that we have, I mean, maybe we can think about the future, but we're not really thinking about the future, not in any sense of responsibility. What I took from it was this, you know, the imposition of ideology on the real world, Christianity in this case, which completely separated them and separates us from the consequences of our actions, and therefore destroys our world.
Right, and there's the contemporary analogy, which they talk about very briefly in 2016 and elsewhere, is the idea that a healthy economy is a growing economy. The foundation of capitalism. But infinite growth is not possible in a finite world. And imagining that infinite growth or other things like the fact that the duty of a corporation is to its shareholders and not to environmental stewardship or anything. Those are ideas, you know? Those are invented by people. And the consequences of those ideas are unfathomably terrible. And it's not impossible to imagine other ideas.
Exactly. Well, this is just a terrific book. Aaron Tier, I want to thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice about Mr. Eternity. I look forward to reading more from your pen, and I so enjoyed our conversation.
Thank you for having me.
Aaron Tier. Read an excerpt from Mr. Eternity by going to writersvoice.net. And if you like our show, why don't you subscribe to the free podcast and tell your radio station you like us, or give us a good review on your podcast app. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.